Welcome. You are listening to AfterSight. This recording is intended solely for individuals who are blind or have low vision.
Thank you for joining us for the New York Times Book Review, read by Nefeli Schneider, featuring book reviews authored by critics from the New York Times. Wake Up and Open Your Eyes by Clay McLeod Chapman. This book was reviewed by Eric Piepenberg. Clay McLeod Chapman knows where readers of his new horror novel, Wake Up and Open Your Eyes, will either buckle in or clock out. The book is set in an apocalyptic America where a conspiracy-driven television network called Fax News unleashes a demonic force that possesses half the country. Noah, a 40-something father, travels to his childhood home in Virginia to find that Fax News has transmuted his conservative parents into bloodthirsty creatures, a painful discovery that forces him on a treacherous journey back to the safety of Brooklyn. Chapman said that if Goodreads is any indication, the make-or-break passage starts around page 48, when Noah is assaulted by his horny mother, whose ghastly flypaper tongue slurps and worms up the divot between his lips before she gruesomely smashes in her skull. Fax News took his mommy away, and now he has no one to protect him from all the monsters under his bed, Chapman writes. Mom's the monster now. Here's the thing. Chapman is 47, grew up in Virginia, lives in Brooklyn, and is a father and self-described left-leaning cis-white male with conservative parents. This novel, he explained, evolved from his need to articulate and find some sort of, if not understanding, catharsis of how you can love someone so much and still stray to opposite ends of the political spectrum. Chapman has long written in horror. As a novelist, this is his 12th book, but also in film, comic books, and podcasts. New York theatergoers might know him as the playwright-performer behind The Pumpkin Pie Show, an evening of creepy monologues that ran for over 20 years in the East Village. During an interview at a cafe in Ditmas Park, the Brooklyn neighborhood where he lives with his wife and two sons, Chapman talked and laughed about finding pleasure in terror and learning to bite his tongue. The interview has been edited and condensed. How autobiographical is the novel? It's not. What I have riffed from my parents is that, in a Southern gentility way, we just don't talk about politics anymore. We've reached the Rubicon, where we're at separate ends of the spectrum. I kept hearing a refrain from other people whose families had shifted in their political views, saying, "It's like my parents were possessed." I took that at face value. Did you tell your parents what the book was about? I did, 2 weeks ago. 2 weeks ago. I kept stalling. We had a half hour to go before leaving for the holidays, and I was like, "Guys, maybe you shouldn't read this one." They understood. My mom, God love her, wants to support and be a loving parent. But it's just not for her. My stepfather inherited a surly, punkish teen dude. I don't know what they did to deserve me writing this book, but that's the icky turmoil that comes with politics at the dinner table. Will they read it? I hope not, for their sakes. What motivated you to mix horror with politics? If Sam Raimi directed the January 6 riots, that's what I envisioned. Chaos, anarchy, kinetic energy. I feel like I screamed for 400 pages, watching the Capitol be immersed by bodies, an assault of people not turning back, a wave that's not going to stop for the vice president or police officers. That was the moment I said, if I'm going to write this type of book, it has to have that level of trauma. George Romero's spirit lives in the story, even though the monsters aren't quite the undead. I love systems collapsing and nobody knows what the heck is going on. The laws of civil society are gone. Decorum is gone. Papa George gave us a template that's going to be durable for decades. A question about subtlety. Fax News. I was the first to do the eye roll. It's so on the nose. But you have to be. The time to go gonzo is here. Did any books get under your skin as inspiration? Sarah Grand's Come Closer in its economy of language, in that you feel every moment of a possession. There's also A Head Full of Ghosts by Paul Tremblay, because in his ambiguous way, you can never say for certain whether the girl actually is possessed. The third one is A Cheat, Pontypool, a triptych of novels by Tony Burgess. He began this idea of a zombie plague by way of words. Was the plan always to release the book around the inauguration? I was very adamant, nearly petulant, with my publisher, wanting this book to come out before the election. Then the election happened. Friends and family have joked about what perfect timing, but I'd rather that not be the case. Dark planets aligned and positioned this book to be a conversation starter. Anything else you want to add? I love my family, and I hope they still love me. The reviewer and interviewer, Eric Pippenberg, has been writing for the New York Times since 2004. He regularly covers film, television, and LGBTQ stories, and has also written about food and travel. He's currently working on a book about gay restaurants to be published by Hachette in 2025. Two novels for cold weather, Joan Aiken's Neo-Gothic and Joseph Ross' Family Epic. These two books were reviewed by Sadie Stein. First book, The Wolves of Willoughby Chase by Joan Aiken. It was dusk, winter dusk. Snow lay white and shining over the pleated hills, and icicles hung from the forest trees. Snow lay piled in the dark road across Willoughby Wold, but from dawn men had been clearing it with brooms and shovels. There were hundreds of them at work, wrapped in sacking because of the bitter cold, and keeping together in groups for fear of the wolves, grown savage and reckless from hunger. I ordered a copy of this childhood favorite with the thought that I might read it to my son if it wasn't too old for him. It was. Aiken's language is steeped in Bronte and Dickens, and the few pages we read aloud required frequent stops to explain portico, oubliette, hoydenish, pelisse, and goffering petticoat frills. I resorted to Google. But that night I picked it up again and found myself as swept away as I was when I first read the book at 9 or 10 years old. Aiken's first novel was my introduction to the Gothic, a lush pastiche that follows the cousins Bonnie and Sylvia from the grandeur of Willoughby Chase to the workhouses of a proto-steampunk London, pursued by thrillingly villainous adults and befriended by Simon, who lives in an underground cavern and communes with animals. He returns in the sequel alongside the plucky cockney Dido Twite, a heroine of Aiken's later books. I remember the hardcover copy I first owned had blurbs on the cover, and my feeling of indignation that one reviewer had described this as a very funny book. It wasn't funny. It was terrifying and dramatic. I felt the orphan's fear, held my breath as I read about the ravening wolves throwing themselves at train windows, and truly grieved when the evil governess, Miss Slycarp, seemed poised to triumph. As an adult, I can see that the book is knowingly florid, skillfully incorporating all the conventions of the genre to exaggerated effect. The Edward Gorey cover is a perfect match for the text, equal parts homage and riff. But the emotion is real, too, and my edition contains a brief introduction by the author's daughter that speaks to this. What started as an arch parody, Lisa Aiken writes, was put aside when her father died and her mother had to support the young family and send her children away. She had certainly reveled in the melodramas she had read as a child, but now that she had experienced tragedy and poverty herself, she could write about them with authority. Another contemporary review I do agree with. As Time put it, this book is a small masterpiece. The Radetzky March by Joseph Roth. Some months ago, a friend and I came across this book at a museum shop. Upon learning I had never read it, or only in that unabsorbing, too young, check it off my list way I read too many things in college when Michael Hoffman's translation came out, She insisted on buying me a copy on the spot. It was one of the great gifts. The most acclaimed of Roth's works, the Radetzky March, named for the Johann Strauss piece, is a multi-generational saga in which one family's story becomes a metonymy for the fate of the often snowy Austro-Hungarian Empire. In 1859, the humbly born Lieutenant Trotta is made a baron after saving the life of Emperor Franz Joseph in battle, thus dragging him into high society. Much to his discomfort, his bravery is distorted and mythologized, obscuring the truth of the incident and setting his family on a perilous course. Every night before retiring, and every morning upon awakening, as if his own life had been traded for a new and alien life manufactured in a workshop, he would repeat his new rank and his new status to himself and walk up to the mirror to confirm that his face was the same. Despite the awkward hardiness of army brethren trying to bridge the gulf left by a sudden and incomprehensible destiny, and in spite of his own vain efforts to encounter everyone as unabashedly as ever, the ennobled Captain Trotta seemed to be losing his equilibrium. He felt he had been sentenced to wear another man's boots for life and walk across a slippery ground, pursued by secret talking and awaited by shy glances. Later generations, now calling themselves the Von Trottas, share none of the Baron's ambivalence or social anxieties, easily inheriting the privileges and entitlements of aristocrats as the empire heaves and shifts. Even as each generation falls further into aimless dissipation, they feel themselves part of a great military dynasty. While the Radetzky March, along with its superb sequel, The Emperor's Tomb, is, to say the least, ambitious in scope, and masterfully so, Roth's genius lies in his mordant, skeptical, but not inhumane understanding of character, and in his evocation of the rich details of meals, of textiles, of costume that mark his world's evolution. That Roth, who would flee Nazism and die in Paris in 1939, was commenting on his own moment is understood. That his work, a deft dissection of the dangers of power and the mutability of empire, remains as relevant as ever, would have seemed so obvious to him as to not bear mentioning. In the book's epilogue, a canary is given a piece of sugar after a funeral. "It will outlive us all," said Trotta. "Thank goodness." The reviewer, Sadie Stein, is a New York City native. She has always been a prolific reader, and her literary interests run from American to French history, thrillers and mysteries, to architecture and design, philosophy to Broadway lyrics. Dark Laboratory, On Columbus, the Caribbean, and the Origins of the Climate Crisis, by Tao Li Goff. This book was reviewed by Elizabeth Rush. The slow-motion disaster that is climate change started with our unearthing long-buried organic matter and lighting it aflame, which released particles into the atmosphere that hold warmth. This is the story we tell ourselves about a central cause of our warming planet. But what if slowing down the climate change juggernaut has proved so difficult, in part because we talk about the problem all wrong? Tao Li Goff's Dark Laboratory, On Columbus, the Caribbean, and the Origins of the Climate Crisis, argues that current scientific discourse obscures the racist roots of our existential predicament, while also overlooking potential strategies of repair and endurance. Goff, an interdisciplinary scholar and writer, contends that to understand our present plight, we need to look back in time, in particular to the arrival of Christopher Columbus in the Caribbean in 1492, which he cites as a marker for the start of globalization. Over the intervening centuries, the region's interconnected islands have served as a kind of testing ground for different colonial practices, chattel slavery, resource extraction, and the classification of flora and fauna, as well as people, that transformed the world, destroying ecosystems, lives, and livelihoods, while simultaneously bearing strange fruit. Dark Laboratory is as interested in identifying the causes of the climate crisis as it is in offering a kind of alternative account of life in the wake of environmental apocalypse. Once I realized that European colonial archives are evidence lockers full of crimes against humanity, I began to stop arguing the case in court, as it were, Gough writes. It becomes liberating, then, to evaluate not what lies enclosed within the walls of colonial architectures, but to begin to comprehend the magnitude of what is outdoors. In this case, outdoors encompasses a lot of different places at different moments in time. Dark Laboratory hops from Jamaica to Hong Kong, New York, and London, all locales to which Gough traces her roots, landing intermittently on a host of other spots in between, Dominica, Tahiti, Sardinia, Hawaii. In each, Gough's ear is tuned to songs of resistance, to what it looks like to make life amid and after colonial subjugation. The result is an assemblage of sorts where blue-footed boobies, coral reefs, and even bat guano play a leading role, illustrating the ways non-human actors and their attendant ecologies have survived human predation. Consider, for instance, the curious case of the Calcutta mongoose in Jamaica, the title of one of Gough's chapters. The animal was imported by a white plantation owner to eat the rats, endemic to Europe, that were eating the sugar cane, endemic to India, that he was hell-bent on exporting to the United States and Europe, where it would be distilled into rum. This tiny passage in a much larger tale of imperial appetites transformed the ecology of Jamaica, leading to, among other things, the near extinction of native ground nesting birds. But instead of portraying the furtive mammal as a culprit, Gough deftly swerves around the familiar story of invasive species to write at length about the mongoose's radical mothering practices. All births within a colony occur on the same night, with the result that all mongoose babies, up to 3 litters a year, belong to all mongoose mothers, a potential blueprint, Gough argues, for collective survival. And yet, much of the popular literature about these creatures paints them as lascivious tricksters, not to be trusted. For whose violence, Gough asks, do they serve as a scapegoat? Aiming to center Black and Indigenous history and ecology, Dark Laboratory is a pointed response to the dominance of scientific rationalism as the language best suited to the climate crisis. Yet Gough's narrative moves so rapidly among disciplines, biology, literature, economics, musicology, geoscience, that it's easy to lose track of where or when we are in space and time. Her episodic style feels purposeful, an obvious rebuke of a more conventional narrative structure, yet the effect can be truly disorienting. There have been many proposals for what to name our particular era: the Anthropocene, the Capitalocene, the Trumpocene. Each has its own origin story, rooted in the sediment or the stock market or the doom scroll. But what if the instinct for linear chronology, for beginnings, middles, and ends, obscures the imbricated injustices that shape the present? As Gough writes, the 21st century requires new genres of climate storytelling to encompass the multiplicity and non-linearity of salvation, if it is possible. Dark Laboratory provides a noble and necessary, if at times unwieldy, example of what one such genre might look like, offering readers a novel account of post-colonial resistance, regeneration, and survival. The reviewer, Elizabeth Rush, is the author of The Quickening: Motherhood, Antarctica, and Cultivating Hope in a Warming World. She teaches creative nonfiction at Brown University. The best cozy romance novels to steam up your nights. The following books are reviewed by Sangu Mandana. Act Your Age, Eve Brown, by Talia Hibbert. We're off to a strong start with one of my favorite novels of any genre. This is the final book in Hibbert's trilogy of romances about the Brown sisters. You don't have to read them in order, and I love them all, but Eve's story has the biggest place in my heart. She is the messy baby of the family, with a sunshine soul and a lifetime of well-suppressed hurt from feeling like an outsider in her overachieving family. When her latest business venture crashes and burns, she's desperate to prove she can stand on her own. Enter Jacob, the perfectionist owner of the Castell Cottage Bed and Breakfast, who reluctantly hires Eve as his new chef after she accidentally runs him over and breaks his arm. There's a lot to love about this book: the cozy setting, the supporting cast, the incredibly hot sex scenes, the humor, every single appearance by Eve's grandma. But what makes it so special to me is the tender and realistic way Hibbert portrays her two neurodivergent protagonists. A Marvelous Light by Freya Marsk. In this dazzling historical fantasy, Robin, a young baron saddled with his dead parents' debts and completely unaware of the secret magical world running a parallel to the Edwardian England he knows, meets Edwin, a magician with a complicated relationship with magic and an even more complicated relationship with his magical family. Adventure, mayhem, and murder naturally ensue. Alongside a beautiful, steamy, and moving romance, expect a plethora of beautiful settings and delightful supporting characters, plus two sequels to dive into when you're done. If you've ever wished for Georgette Heyer's wit in a more queer, inclusive, and magical story, this is the book for you. Cemetery Boys by Aidan Thomas. A book about death, ghosts, and a cemetery might sound like the furthest thing from cozy. But Thomas's beautiful debut, set in a Latino community in Los Angeles, combines magical realism, teen drama, family conflict, and first love into a novel that's warm, moving, and relatable. Yadriel is a trans boy looking for acceptance from his family of Brujk, or sorcerers. Determined to prove himself, he taps into his ancestral power to summon a ghost. Of course, things don't quite go according to plan, and he finds himself stuck with the specter of Julian, his school's resident bad boy, who needs Yadriel's help solving the mystery of his death before he can move on. But the longer the pair spend together, the less Yadriel wants Julian to go. A Duke by Default by Alyssa Cole. Frankly, all I needed to hear about this book were the words "hot mess of an heiress starts an apprenticeship with a sexy sword maker in Scotland," and I was sold. At first glance, this sounds like a historical romance, but it's actually a delightful, sexy, contemporary novel packed with Cole's signature wit, a spirited and vulnerable heroine, and very hot and very reluctant Duke. Bringing Down the Duke by Evie Dunmore. Now this, on the other hand, is a historical romance. The first volume in Dunmore's magnificent League of Extraordinary Women series, Bringing Down the Duke, introduces readers to Annabelle, a working-class young woman, and her three unapologetically political and unconventional best friends who are in the first cohort of female university students at Oxford. Annabelle is there on a scholarship, in exchange for which she has to recruit prominent men to support the growing women's suffrage movement. Her target? Sebastian, an icy, influential, and inconveniently handsome duke. Sebastian has a lot of privilege and prejudices to unpack over the course of the book, but his story is a joy to read, as is his and Annabelle's growing attraction. There are a lot of laughs and tears. The supporting cast is absolutely stellar, and the romance is a deliciously steamy, slow burn. The Spell Shop by Sarah Beth Durst. As much as I adore grumpy men as love interests, I have an enormous soft spot for grumpy women as protagonists. The heroine of The Spell Shop, Kiela, is a taciturn, reclusive librarian. She's also loyal, generous, and deeply lonely. When her city is destroyed, Kiela flees the burning wreckage with as many precious books as she can carry and finds herself in the only place she could think to hide, her late parents' cottage. Expect slow days in a sleepy coastal village, baked goods, winged kittens, a sentient spider plant, and a hot man who builds bookshelves for our heroine. I, for one, couldn't ask for more. The Full Moon Coffee Shop by Mai Mochizuki, translated by Jesse Kirkwood. I have to admit that I'm cheating a bit here. This is not actually a romance, at least in the traditional sense. But if you're anything like me, you read romance not only for the love stories, banter, and smut, but also for that soft, joyful sense of healing a good romance gives you. And few books lately have made me feel as soft, joyful, and healed as The Full Moon Coffee Shop. It's best to go into the book knowing as little as possible. All you really need to know is that it's a charming, contemporary fantasy, and as you might have guessed from the cover, it does involve cats. The reviewer, Sangu Mandana, is the best-selling author of the cozy romantic fantasy, The Very Secret Society of Irregular Witches, and the upcoming A Witch's Guide to Magical Innkeeping, and several other novels. Thank you for joining us for the New York Times Book Review, read by Nefeli Schneider.
If you enjoyed this program, please register for our free services at www.aftersight.org or by calling 303-786-7777.